Let's start in Luke chapter 5. On one occasion, while the crowd was pressing in on him to hear the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret. And he saw two boats by the lake, but the fishermen had gone out of them and were washing their nets. Getting into one of the boats, which was Simon's, he asked him to put out a little from the land. And he sat down and taught the people from the boat. And when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch." And Simon answered, "Master, we toiled all night and took nothing, but at your word I will let down the nets." And when they had done this, they enclosed a large number of fish, and their nets were breaking. They signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both the boats so that they began to sink. But when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." For he and all who were with him were astonished at the catch of fish that they had taken. And so also were James and John, sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, "Do not be afraid. From now on you will be catching men." And when they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him. And now from John. After this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, and he revealed himself in this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, "I am going fishing." They said to him, "We will go with you." They went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, "Children, do you have any fish?" They answered him, "No." He said to them, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find them." So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. That disciple whom Jesus loved therefore said to Peter, "Is it the Lord?" When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. The other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. When they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire in place, with fish laid on it and bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish that you have just caught." So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." Now none of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and so with the fish. This was now the third time that Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. The word of the Lord. Let us welcome Dr. Watt as he gives his message entitled "Breakfast with Jesus."
Good morning. Thank you for your flexibility in having an expectation of the way things might be and for adjusting this morning on short notice. I had been thinking I might just slip in here and no one would notice the difference. I always thought Rut and I looked a lot alike. But then not too long ago, we were chatting one evening and just sort of walking down the sidewalk, and someone saw us and said, "You know, you guys look like Harry Potter and Dumbledore." I haven't figured out which of us is which just yet, but we'll get there. I hope you've enjoyed these two accounts this morning. One is right at the beginning and the other right at the end of Jesus' public ministry. And they have a lot of things in common, although I'm not particularly focusing on that. I'll simply reference them. But they give us a window into something that is so valuable, which is, if you're going to know anything about Jesus, And if you're going to know Jesus, you have to sort of know, well, you know, how did things work when he was on earth? What was it like? Because none of us was there. These were events a long, long time ago, as you know very well. One of the reasons I like to take people, especially Geneva students and others, over to Israel, as we try to do every couple of years from campus here, is we get to sort of walk around and see the lay of the land as it was and as it is today. Although not long ago I was trying to invite a friend to come and be there, and he appropriately said, he declined to go on the trip, and he said, I'd rather walk with Jesus than walk where Jesus walked. I thought, fair enough, I actually agree with that. I think the priority is right. However, I'm still interested in what's it like just being with Jesus? How does that work, and what's the experience like? I always feel like it's something I've been working on for a very long time. And I've made progress, and then other times I just feel like there's so much more where I haven't gone yet. You know, walking in step with Jesus, like walking in step with the Spirit. Like, what is that like? You know, Bible uses many, many terms like, you know, hungering for righteousness, or, you know, sheep attuned to the shepherd's voice. And that helps me with those kind of metaphors. But still, you know, what's it like? And so forth. Here's a thought for you. I'm not trying to do the whole thing in one shot, but here's a thought for you. Walking with Jesus is being attuned to his voice. And I go on the assumption everybody hears voices. Now, I don't mean like you're psychotic. I don't mean it that way. There are some people that hear those kind of voices. I'm not talking about that. I think everybody hears voices. We're tuned in to what people think and expect and kind of wish us to do and would like to be kind of to some degree like people are expecting us to be. We all are tuned into voices. It could be voices of friends, peers, family. I think some people hear nothing but their own voice. I think a lot of people these days are tuned into the voices they get through electronic screens. They can't escape the draw of the event. You know, screens are events. When I was a teenager, though I grew up in a generally religious household, and I was generally part of sort of religious circuits. I didn't grow up RP. I grew up in another denominational tradition. The voice I listened to was rationalism. It was very simple, it seemed to me, and very obvious. Rationalism, thinking logically, empirically, the way things are is the way things are. You've got to work with them. I heard often this being said. This is very important to where I'm going today, okay? I often heard this being said. We know that after Jesus, you know, lived his life and was put to death, whatever happened that weekend, in other words, just before what I read to you in John 21, whatever happened that weekend, it was some sort of spiritual event, but, I was told repeatedly, but we all know that when a living being dies, that's the end of the story. So whatever happened, it was a spiritual event, but Jesus was dead, and that's the end of the story. That's the rationalism, albeit religious rationalism, that I grew up with. And so I'm really interested in passages like this for actually a very, very down-to-earth. I'm going to say a single thing really this morning, and that is just the fact that physically, you and I might say normally and naturally, Jesus is not only present on earth, but after the fact of his death, he's still present. And there's a little phrase, it's actually a single word here, that usually gets translated in the Bibles, manifested, okay? Shows up in this among many other passages. Jesus manifested himself by the lake. And the downside of the word manifest, it just sounds very awkward. Like you would never say, I manifested myself at class this morning, right? If you said that, you're weird. Let's just get that out there, right? You would not say that. But that's what I keep saying about Jesus. In fact, Gospel of John, as well as John's first epistle, keep saying Jesus was manifested. It could have said he was there. That would be true. He showed up. That would be true. And a lot of things like that. But he was manifested. John keeps using that to describe the fact that Jesus isn't merely present, though he is, but he is disclosing himself. And furthermore, if he's God's Son who is with God for all eternity, according to John 1 and 1:1 and following, he is representing and manifesting the presence of God every time Jesus shows up. So it may be important for you to be in class or to be at some special event. It is important, especially important when we think of Jesus manifesting himself and thereby the presence of God as well. In fact, the book of Acts describes what Jesus is doing over this roughly six-week period after his being raised from the dead. And this is the phrase it uses. It was a series of confirming indicators. I like that. In other words, things that point to he's alive and he's physically present. Confirming indicators by which people around him could start to wrap their mind around the fact that yes, he was really dead at the end, you know, the beginning of that weekend and through the weekend, and now he's really alive. And let's face it, let's be fair. If you're a reasonable person, you ought to struggle a little bit with that. You should. I'm very sympathetic when people say, I can believe that Jesus was a human being who lived 2,000 years ago, but this resurrection thing just really pushes the limits of credibility. I'm thinking, good, at least you're thinking about how strange and how contradictory to expectation and reasonability that is. He's dead and then he's alive. It doesn't normally work that way. You all know that. You all know that. And so the task for a lot of people in his day is going to be, how do you relate to Jesus before, in other words, the years they walked with him, and then how do you relate with him now? Because things aren't quite the same anymore. I think of Mary Magdalene, who encounters him in the garden the morning of the resurrection, and she does what a lot of us naturally do when you see someone you really miss, you give him a hug, and Jesus puts the brakes on that and says, I've not yet ascended to the Father. Something's changed. Something's really changed. So here we are. I've called this breakfast by the lake. Here we are, on the one hand, with just, if you will, a normal, plain old individual, a human being as genuinely, normally human as all of us here. And despite what had happened, he manifests himself, familiar territory. By the way, it's kind of fun to walk around the perimeter of Lake Galilee. My favorite and least favorite part, by the way, is roughly the central western shoreline, because there's all these discos there now. I just think where Jesus walked, you can boogie. You know, there's something wrong about that. But anyway, it's the down to earth. It's a place. It's, you know, it's not like it's different ground. It's the same place. And here we are with Jesus now at this place, John 21, somewhere near it anyway, near where he must have run into Peter 3 to 4 years earlier. They were probably acquainted before that. And Peter has this extraordinary experience. Here's some guy who says, throw the net on the other side and you'll get a massive haul of fish, when they spent all night working and they didn't get anything. And at first, now that we're back at the end of the ministry time, at first he doesn't recognize Jesus. They're not that far apart. He hears the voice. He sees the form. I don't know how many feet apart or yards apart they are, but they're far enough. He doesn't recognize Jesus, even though he's been with Jesus for the previous 3 years. Something is changing. Something is changing. And I don't know exactly what it is that makes the lights go on. All right? Because he's taken off his outer cloak. He's working, you know, handling the nets and fish and all this kind of stuff. But something happens and the lights go on. He realizes, whoa, I thought maybe this was all over. No, he's standing there. And contrary to this you know, empirical rationalist training by which I had been shaped growing up, something even stranger was to happen. They get to the shore. They pull in this massive haul of 153 fish. Pretty impressive. I struggled to get one fish on a hook. That's hard enough. And they get up to the shore, and Jesus had already made a fire. He's gotten food from somewhere else. I don't know if that's a miracle or not, but just we do know he has the food there, invites them to bring more fish, and he eats breakfast with them. And would you just pause and take this in for just a second? Think about this. He eats breakfast. By the way, people in that day basically had two meals a day. One was mid to late morning. We'll call it breakfast. Actually, brunch might be a little bit closer to it. Brunch and an evening meal. Typically two meals a day is the way most people in that society in that day would have a typical dinner day. And it's the plainness and the simplicity of it which is so striking. Here's a man who was physically dead and certified that way. Now, alive, he's made breakfast, he's presented himself to them, and he's sitting down just for brunch or breakfast with them. And the lights at some point have gone on, and he realizes this. And the connection, and this is the single thread I'm trying to sew through this morning with you, is the physical Jesus. The human Jesus. I'm not saying that's the whole picture on Jesus. I'm just saying it's this vital part that we have to keep before us. Son of God, and yet manifested genuinely as a human being, not only before the weekend's events, but now afterwards, still physical. I don't know how to relate the body before, the body after, because all these people seem to not recognize Jesus after. And yet when Thomas says, I want to see the marks of the injuries, he gets to see them. There's a continuity of some kind. Now think about the claim and the implicit message of that continuity. Message is, if God had Jesus not stuck in death, in other words, he couldn't be held by death. If God worked in such a way that his son, who can experience and did experience a horrible, grisly death, weak in the grave, and then physically alive at the beginning of the new week, here's the message for you and me. What's happened to him is awaiting those who are joined to him. And though I do not get exactly how that works, 1 Corinthians helps me with a couple metaphors. You know, how does the pre-resurrection you relate to the post-resurrection you? The metaphors, just one of the three that shows up in the chapter there is, it's a little bit like seed and tree, right? You plant a seed, it weighs part of an ounce. You put it in the ground, if you wait long enough, you know, some decades or even some hundreds of years, you have an absolutely massive, you know, thing there that towers over you. Is it the same or is it different from the seed? And the answer is yes. Right? It's both the same and it's different. The continuity is there. And that's crucial. Because the doctrine of the bodily resurrection of Jesus is what makes our faith unique. If there is no bodily resurrection of Jesus, we have some nice ethics, right, that can be summarized in, hey, treat people decently. That's the golden rule, like you'd want to be treated. We have some good ethics, but that's it. Paul puts it this way in 1 Corinthians 15, we're to be pitied. Because we've only believed in Jesus and it's only relevant to this life. But if there is a bodily resurrection, then the end of the story isn't the end of the story. Pretty impressive. And that what happened to him is awaiting you and me if we're united to him by faith. That's the connection. And that's what ended my attempt at rationalist Christianity, because the two don't fit well. It was the end of that. And I have a closing thought for you, In this, you may say, well, I find it hard to wrap my mind around that. I still do. I do. You say it may be hard, even with that, to live the challenges of life. And I agree. It may be that you and I are going to be a little bit like Peter, who, faced with all of these things, now has to figure, well, what next, especially the part we didn't read, which is what comes right after our passage in John 21. Jesus asking Peter, Peter, do you love me? Remember, Peter just denied him days earlier. Peter, do you love me? What do you say to those kinds of things? Sometimes we ought to be without words. God sometimes uses the brick walls of the miracles to bring us to, if we're honest, a crisis that says, I can't get this. I don't know how I feel towards this, but I do know I want to be connected with Him. And I think being needy is not a bad way to go, especially in a society which says, we're going to tell you all the ways in which you are just right, so unique, almost perfect, and happiness is owed to you. These are the mantras of 21st century America. You hear them everywhere. Everywhere. But just maybe, if you would reckon with this impossible peace, the bodily resurrection of Jesus, who had meals beforehand and breakfast afterward. And if you feel you've hit a brick wall, that's okay. I like the humility expressed by somebody like an Abraham Lincoln, who once said, I've been driven many times upon my knees by the overwhelming conviction that I had nowhere else to go. He added, my own wisdom and that of all who were around me simply seemed insufficient for that day. That's how I often feel about miracles like this. And yet, my existence and my eternal future are tied up with it. And I hope the same for you. Father, you know the souls, the state of being, the position of mind and heart of every individual here this morning. May you step so close, that they may know you. Amen.
Let's stand and sing.